This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. You know, one of the many great things about living here in North Carolina is the way they make it easy for you to vote. Early and one-stop voting encourage greater participation, which in turn strengthens the democratic process. But of course, integrity is also important. There have to be safeguards to protect against fraud. True the Vote is a movement that has sprung up as a self-appointed guardian of electoral integrity. Though the movement is controversial, critics charge the movement is just a cover for a larger effort to suppress minority voting. Well, joining us now is Christian Adams, and he's an election attorney with True the Vote. Christian Adams, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
What is the extent of voter fraud nationally here in North Carolina? How much is there?
Well, it's hard to know because folks in academia don't seem to want to really quantify it. Efforts to do so by groups like the Brennan Center have been flawed. They leave a lot of voter fraud out of the reports. So we really don't know how much voter fraud is out there, but we know that it's a problem in many places, and some people want to do something about it.
You know, I'm looking at a report here that's just out. It's funded by the Carnegie Corporation and the Knight Foundation, and it took a look at voter fraud, comprehensive look back to 2000. It says that in-person voter impersonation on Election Day, there were 10 cases out of 146 million voters. That is 1 in 15 million. So according to this comprehensive report by Carnegie Knight, it's vanishingly small.
Well, the problem is that comprehensive report really isn't so comprehensive. It was done by News 21, and they actually left some cases out of voter impersonation that I actually litigated in federal court for the United States Department of Justice. So I know for a fact that there's missing instances in that report.
Now, this project also says that there's more fraud in absentee ballots and voter registration than any other category. So they've got 491 cases of absentee ballot fraud, 400 cases of registration fraud. A required photo ID at the polls would not have prevented those cases. So photo ID doesn't prevent the cases where there's a far greater instance, although still relatively small, than in voting at the polls.
Well, photo ID does help prosecute in-person voter fraud at the polls because you can lock down the identity of the person doing it. The defendant can't say, well, that wasn't me, that was somebody else. So it shows up in a lot of different ways to help. You're right, absentee ballot fraud is a huge problem in this country. And anytime you make a proposal to do something about it, as they've done in Kansas, you have the same usual suspects who oppose any changes to absentee ballot voting. So there's just a general tension between one side that believes in election integrity and the other side, and they're in a permanent state of tug of war.
So we've got this report that I'm looking at that was pretty well funded and fairly comprehensive. You may have left out a couple cases, but voter ID would have caught those 10 people since 2000. Once again, where's your data? Why do you think it's so pervasive if you say you can't nail it down?
Well, what's pervasive? I mean, how many instances of voter fraud equals pervasive? No one can ever answer that question. When they do, it's usually a number that is awfully high. And I would ask the question, how much voter fraud is okay? Do we accept one unit of corruption, two units, 50, 100? I don't think it's good to have any voter fraud. And we should applaud people who are doing something about it, not criticize them.
Yeah, no, you're right. And you don't want any at all. You've got 10 cases in 146 million. And then it says that. So then the question becomes, what is the appropriate approach to stop those 10 out of 146 million? This report finds photo ID laws and other new voting restrictions disproportionately affect minorities, students, the disabled, and the elderly. Do you think we should find different approaches, that this one clearly is one that that suppresses voting among the most vulnerable in our population?
Well, just about no court has ever agreed with that conclusion, whether it's in Pennsylvania, Indiana, the United States Supreme Court, the Billups v. Georgia, case after case after case has disagreed with that conclusion that there's any discriminatory effect. Voter ID should be free, easy to get, and readily available. If you do that, the arguments against it are pretty doggone weak.
One of the complaints that critics raise is that this is by and large a movement that is funded by, supported by, and the impetus behind it is from conservatives. Donna Yowell is the state director for True the Vote in North Carolina. She has said it's time to wake up, get out and work for your conservative views. November is just around the corner. We have to take back Congress or socialism will be in full force. She's headed through the vote in North Carolina. Does that disturb you?
Well, look, I'm not going to criticize conservatives because they happen to be the only people right now that seem to care about voter fraud in North Carolina. But take a look at Harold Metz, a senator from Rhode Island, an African-American sponsor of the voter ID bill, a Democrat in Rhode Island, which passed both Democrat houses in Rhode Island and became the law. Look at Archer Davis, former Democrat member of the Congressional Black Caucus in Congress, is now a big supporter of voter ID because he has seen the fraud firsthand and how it corrupts particularly minority voting districts. And so the tide is turning on this. Actually, the tide never was bad because 80% of Americans support voter ID. And it's bipartisan, it's cross-racial, and a majority of African-Americans support it, a majority of Hispanics, women, Democrats support it in majority numbers, so do Republicans. It's only a very tiny fringe that stands against voter integrity efforts like voter ID.
You know, when we talk about voter ID, that is, again, the numbers that have been documented seem to be relatively small relative to absentee and voter registration. So I want to get your opinion on that because, you know, we've got Acorn in 2008 supporting the Democrats. Now we've got this guy, Nathan Spruill, who had been who got $3 million from the Republicans. He's neck deep in allegations. In fact, the RNC had to fire him because of voter registration fraud allegations. For the Republic, what do we do about that? How do we address absentee ballot and registration fraud, which seem to be, by and large, the larger problems?
Well, there's a couple tools to do that, and that's what the group in North Carolina and the True the Vote nationally is trying to do. One of them is Section 8 of Motor Voter. Section 8 of Motor Voter empowers people to bring cases, federal court cases, to require the voter rolls to be cleaned up. In short of suing people, if you don't want to go to court, you alert election officials about particular problems on the rolls, and that's exactly what the groups in North Carolina are doing. Look, you have counties in North Carolina with more people registered to vote than you have people alive, according to the Election Assistance Commission data that was released after the 2010 election. And so there's a problem nationwide. We have over 160 counties, some states, with more people on the voter rolls than people alive. And nobody should criticize good volunteer citizens who want to go out, examine those voter rolls, and bring to the attention of election officials where the problems might be. That's something that we should all applaud. That's not something we should demonize and spy on.
That's not something we do on election day, right at the polls. You wait.
That's right.
Yeah, after the fact.
You do it ahead of time.
Yeah.
You do it well in advance of the election. Federal law doesn't allow you to remove people who are inactive just because they're inactive. Yeah. Right before the election. But if they're dead, you can remove them up until November 5th.
Christian Adams, so good to talk with you. Thank you for joining us.
Very good.
Christian Adams, an election attorney with True the Vote. We'll continue our conversation on voting in North Carolina on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Election day less than 2 weeks away, and we've been talking about True the Vote, which organizers say is an effort to prevent voter fraud. But is voter fraud a problem? We talked about a recently released report. It was funded by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and the Knight Foundation, turned up exactly 10 cases of voter impersonation since 2000 among 146 million registered voters. And that is the thing that voter ID is supposed to prevent. It would have prevented 10 cases out of 146 million. Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights recently published a report called Abridging the Vote. It took a look at True the Vote and the campaign in North Carolina. Devin Burkhardt is co-author of the report. Devin's vice president of the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights, and he joins us now. Devin, welcome.
Hi, Frank. Good to be with you.
So tell us a little bit about what you found in terms of the True the Vote campaign.
Well, what we found in the state of North Carolina is that there are not one but two different efforts to try – statewide efforts to try to abridge the vote and block people from participating on election day, to deter people from exercising that most fundamental and foundational right, and that is participating in the democratic process by voting.
Yeah, but look, they're saying we're not trying to abridge the vote. Voter fraud, it corrupts the system. You don't have any integrity if you have fraud. And what we're trying to do is point out those cases in which there's fraud and jeopardizes the entire process. No, we're not trying to abridge the vote at all.
Right. And the comments by Mr. Adams would be laughable if the implications of voter suppression weren't so tragic and having such an impact. What we know is that these voter suppression efforts are a problem in search of a solution, a solution in search of a problem. And moreover, the efforts, we know that you're far more likely to be struck by lightning or to see a UFO than you are to be a victim of voting fraud. When you get beyond that and you start unpacking the rationale for these efforts to so-called true the vote, what you find, rather, is a highly partisan and deeply political and very cynical effort to try and prevent minority communities in particular, as well as the elderly and poor folks and students, from exercising that constitutionally protected right.
Now, what's your evidence for that, that it is in fact a concerted effort among, in this case, conservatives?
Well, what we know, for instance, if you look at the case of True the Vote nationally, the organization itself began as a Tea Party organization with a very conservative message in Houston, Texas. They relied on the very conservative network of Tea Party organizations around the country to develop this national movement. And if you look in the case of North Carolina, for instance, both of the national both of the statewide projects, both the Voter Integrity Project and the True the Vote North Carolina network, are run by individuals who have made it clear that they have deeply partisan efforts. As you mentioned, Donna Yowell, the head of the statewide effort for True the Vote there, has made it clear that her specific goal is to make sure that President Obama is not reelected. So the evidence overwhelmingly at the both the national and the state level is that there are deeply partisan efforts here involved to try to disenfranchise folks by not allowing them to participate.
What are some of the other ways? We know that the legislation is one of the efforts that would, True the Vote would say, eliminate fraud, bring integrity to the process. Others say suppress voting. What about poll watchers and other things that have sort of been part of this question?
Right. Catherine Engelbrecht, the founder of True the Vote there in Houston, lays out kind of a three-point agenda for True the Vote's efforts nationally. The first is to research the registry. The second is poll watching. And the third, as she likes to call it, is to fix what needs to be fixed. In that first case, in terms of researching the registry, that is, as your previous guest talked about, the effort to try to purge the voting rolls of people they think are not qualified. We know in the case of North Carolina, for instance, when the Voter Integrity Project there filed nearly 30,000 objections to people on the voting rolls, that it turns out when election officials went through those nearly 30,000 complaints, they didn't find a single instance of anyone who shouldn't have voted who voted. So what it does, however, in practice, is it bogs down the system. It makes it harder for election officials to do their work in helping people actually exercise the franchise when it gets closer to Election Day.
But in this
the second of the
go ahead.
Oh,
yeah.
Go ahead.
No.
I was
going to
say the second of those areas, I think, is important, and that's poll watching. This is during the election cycle, preventing people from exercising their right to vote, both inside the polls. By registering as poll watchers and challenging as many people as possible, which not only deters people from participating in the first place, but it also slows the process, which also deters people. And then outside the polls, having so-called election monitors outside taking photographs, taking down license plate numbers, and generally creating an atmosphere of hostility outside the polls, which also has that deterring and chilling effect of people participating in the process. And then the third, I think, is also important for North Carolinians to note that when they talk about fixing what needs to be fixing, they're talking about a legislative effort to try and pass things like voter identification laws, to pass things like more restrictive efforts. So it's not really about integrity. It's about narrowing the franchise and those who can participate effectively in the process on Election Day.
Tell us more about the organization here in North Carolina. Where are most of the volunteers in North Carolina or the organizations located?
Well, that was an interesting finding in the study we did about True the Vote. We found that overwhelmingly, the volunteer network is centered in areas that have the largest concentrations of African American and the Latino population. Particularly if you look in Wake County, for instance, the True the Vote has 71 different volunteers registered as of the beginning of October. And those volunteers are going to be there on election day in precincts, specifically doing both the internal efforts to try to challenge as many people as possible, as well as to kick off folks from the rolls, and the outside to try to create this atmosphere of hostility, particularly in minority areas where they think they'll have the most impact.
Are there any state laws that regulate the behavior and activities of groups like this? Can anybody show up at the polls and saying, I'm here to protect integrity?
No, they can't. In fact, in North Carolina, election law states that you have to be registered and be a participant in that precinct to show up on election day and to go ahead and act as a challenger. You also have to register as a challenger with a political party to be one of the election monitors inside. None of that, however, is required to be for registration outside the polls. And that's where we think we're going to see also as much of an impact in terms of those people standing around taking photos and taking pictures. It's a much more gray area. And we're concerned about the implications of that, of chilling people from, you know, staying in line and participating, given that level of hostility and given the historical context of voter suppression and voter intimidation efforts in the state.
Well, let's talk about that historical context. And right now I want to introduce Irving Joyner, who is with us. He's a professor at North Carolina Central University's School of Law. He has studied the history of voting rights in the U.S. And Irving Joyner, welcome back to the State of Things. So good to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me.
Tell us about that. I mean, I think it's important to put this story in the context of efforts to suppress particularly the black vote in the United States. Give us the history.
Well, you know, as some people will remember that we had a civil war.
I wasn't there, but I was told.
And I've heard that also, that resulted in the emancipation of slaves. Which led to the enactment of the 15th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which prohibited people from preventing African Americans and other racial minorities from voting. And it was the beginning of the political franchise for African Americans. So we're talking about in 1868. And African Americans took that seriously. And they actually went out and began to register, and they began to vote, and to vote in large numbers. And in North Carolina, it was very enthusiastic voting, where African Americans joined in coalitions with whites, and ended up with a large number of African Americans being elected to the North Carolina General Assembly and to various local and municipal positions within the state. So it was a part of what we call the first Reconstruction, where African Americans were robust participants in the American franchise. And so there was then ongoing efforts by former Confederate soldiers or former slave owners to cut that coalition out. And so by threats of intimidation, any number of efforts to frighten off African-Americans engaged in efforts to keep them.
Now, how did that work? What were those efforts?
Well,
we're talking about now the sort of the 1870s, and right. This is when things start to turn.
Well, actually, violence, you know, going in, burning homes, beating up people, killing people, lynching people, threatening their families. But, you know, in North Carolina, unlike some of the other southern states, African Americans continued to vote. And really, up until 1898. When we had the Wilmington race riots, African Americans voted in large numbers and were responsible for the election of governors and all other political figures. After 1898, it dropped off as the Democratic Party came into power and imposed.
Well, shot its way into power. We should talk about what happened in 1898
in Wilmington. Yeah, the only coup d'etat that has occurred in North Carolina history, where a legally elected government was overthrown by force of arms here in Wilmington. And that ended the large-scale participation of African Americans in the political franchise. We had laws requiring poll taxes, laws dealing with literacy tests. We had gerrymandering of political districts and a continuation of the violence that had been directed into African-American communities, and the voting strength went down. It took a plunge.
We should probably point out that that government, that local government in Wilmington, North Carolina, then the most the wealthiest city in North
yes.
Carolina, a majority black population, and the wealthiest, most prosperous, was a coalition government of white and black,
yes.
poor white, and not all poor white, but the coalition, that fusion party, represented a pretty serious threat to the old Democratic elite.
Yeah, and it represented really the ideal of democracy. Where you have people coming across racial lines, socioeconomic lines, to join together to fight for common issues, common goals, and to participate jointly in moving forward the political franchise. And that occurred. But there were those who did not want African-Americans being in a position to lord over them. And, in fact, that was the campaign. Josephus Daniels with the News and Observer constantly with cartoons depicting these African-Americans as vultures lording over whites, and race hatred being developed to turn whites against blacks and vice versa. And the campaign succeeded.
And it was a violent campaign, a coup d'etat, as you said. The federal government did nothing about it, which sent the signal, I think, to the legislature and to the rest of the South, legislatures all throughout the South, that these more robust Jim Crow laws and repressive voting laws could be passed without any worry about federal intervention.
Right. And they were. And they were effective. So what you have is roughly from 1900 until 1968, no African-American was elected to the North Carolina General Assembly. And in 1968, one individual, Henry Fry from Greensboro, was elected. But, you know, during that period, there were some African-Americans who did vote. But in small numbers, they braved the intimidation. But when you're voting in small numbers, you're not a threat. And even though in a lot of the counties in the eastern part of North Carolina, there were majority black populations during that time, and populations in which African Americans, had they been able to vote, could have elected representatives of their choice to be in those positions. But because of the intimidation and because of the culture of the time, African Americans were afraid and did not come out in large numbers, Durham being one exception to that. But then even here, you didn't have the vast majority of African Americans coming out to vote.
So True the Vote, that campaign, that effort, what does that look like to you?
Well, it looks like a revival of the old effort to split the coalition. Right now, we have a coalition of African Americans and progressive whites and poor people and Latinos and Indians and others who have joined together for what I call the second Reconstruction. And as a result of that, you have a significant increase in the number of African Americans elected that in the North Carolina General Assembly. We have African Americans who are serving now in Congress. We have African-American mayors, they're on the city council, they're on the school board, and all of this result basically from coalition politics. And so now there is an effort to mute out these minorities on the, specious claim that somehow they're engaged in voter fraud. To some people, for an African-American to vote is fraudulent. But, you know, we believe that we are part of the franchise, and we have then a constitutional right to exercise our right to vote, and we do.
I'm going to continue this conversation about voting in North Carolina and the U.S., but first I want to thank Devin Burkhardt, who is the Vice President of the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights. Devin, thank you for talking to us about your report on True the Vote. Thanks for talking with
us. Thank you.
Dr. Irving Joyner, professor at North Carolina Central University's Law School, will be with us when we return, and we'll take a look at voting technology and the impact that that has on the vote. Stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking today about the history of voting. Irving Joyner is with us today. He's a professor at North Carolina Central's Law School. Joining us now, Jason Roberts. Jason's a political science professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You take a look at the way technology has changed over time for voting and its influence on voting patterns. Tell us a little bit about that. We never really think about the way voting machines themselves, except when they just plain don't work, but their influence on voting.
Well, there's been a long history of this. In the early days of the country, people voted with ballots that were handed to them by party workers when they got to the polling place. We only adopted the secret or Australian ballot that we use now in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. And those ballots have evolved over time in terms of how they're organized, what kinds of machines you use, and the kind of paper and whatnot that they're printed upon.
And the ballots are interesting, too. Here in North Carolina, for instance, you have to be told about straight party line voting. There's a wrinkle in that the party line vote, if you vote for one party, does not include the presidential race. Tell us about how that developed and what that means in terms of voting in North Carolina.
Well, it's certainly something that's uniquely North Carolina. About 35 states, I believe, allow voters to check one box and cast a ballot for many officials of the same party. But in 1967, North Carolina changed their straight ticket voting law so that it would no longer apply to presidential elections. This happened because for most of the second half of the 20th century, North Carolina's state elected officials were all Democrats. Many were conservatives, but it was largely a one-party state. And nationally, the presidential nominees tended to be more liberal than people in North Carolina. We had George McGovern, Hubert Humphrey, and others. And the thing that people see with these straight ticket options is that it makes it easier for people to cast one ballot for everyone and be done. So what North Carolina legislators feared is that people would go into the polls and want to vote for Richard Nixon, cast a straight Republican ticket, and leave without voting for many state legislators that perhaps they wanted to vote for. So they changed that law in 1967 and said, okay, if you're going to vote a straight ticket, that's great, but it can't apply to the presidential election. The effect of that has been very, very unusual in that North Carolina regularly is one of the top states in the country in terms of what we call undervote for president. So people show up, they cast a ballot, but there's no vote recorded for president.
Because they've voted the party line and they didn't realize that even if they were told, they may have forgotten whatever reason. It didn't count for the president, so that's not.
Well, that's what we suspect. You know, it's hard to know exactly why everyone didn't do that. Some people may have chosen not to cast a ballot for president, but it seems unlikely that all of them did. So, for example, in 2008, the election was very close in North Carolina. Barack Obama won with approximately 14,000 more votes than John McCain, but there were about 90,000 ballots in North Carolina that did not record a choice for president, which is considerably more than the margin of victory.
Yeah, so it could have gone the other way, and that's been true from the time this particular ballot was introduced.
That's correct.
So what about the technology? You know, I mean, it seems to me, and let's talk about it in terms of fraud. Any technology, any way that you vote, of course, is open to fraud. The term stuffing the ballot box had to do with literally putting pieces of paper in a box, right? Are there forms of technology that are somehow safer, that are more fraud-resistant?
Well, all things that we use today are much more fraud-resistant than things that were used in the 19th century. When party workers were handing out ballots, it was very easy for people to stuff as many as they wanted to in a box, and often they were encouraged to do so. We actually have very safe, if you want to say it that way, voting technology in the U.S. today. The instances of in-person voter fraud are incredibly rare and hard to find. So fraud's not so much an issue. There are certain technologies that make it more or less difficult for people's votes to be recorded. Many of your listeners may remember in 2000, a big controversy in Florida was the design of the ballot. The butterfly ballot that used punch card technology is a technology that's associated with more voter errors and more voters seeing their votes not being counted.
How about here in North Carolina? We have a variety of machines that are used, and I guess it's up to the county to decide which ones they want to use. Is that right?
That's true. That's true in all states. The Constitution lets states decide how they want to administer their election technology, and most states delegate those powers to counties. And so you see a lot of variation in terms of the technology used and how many voting machines are available in various counties. And that's often correlated with the wealthiness of a county. Counties that are better off financially tend to have newer, more machines. Poorer counties tend to have fewer machines that don't work as well.
And when you say don't work as well, you mean don't work the way they were designed to work or aren't as efficient in recording your vote accurately?
Both those things are true. I mean, older machines are more likely to malfunction. And it's also the case that there are certain technologies that are better at recording people's intentions than others. One of the better ones is what's used in my home county here, Orange County, is the you fill in little bubbles for the person you want to vote for, and it's entered into a Scantron-type machine. People who've taken standardized tests in high school or college, I'm sure, are very familiar with those. That's one of the more accurate technologies that exists.
And what are some of the other machines that are used in North Carolina?
Well, some places use the touchscreen voting, where I think the analogy most people use is it's like an ATM machine or an iPad. You walk up, you're going to see your choices on a screen, and you press things on a screen to record your choices.
And that sounds like it's a pretty good system. There's a name, it's a box, press it, and you win. And if you don't like that, you change it before you walk out, I guess.
It is a good system. Some people worry that, often people worry about the software behind these, that if they're actually pushing a button, is it programmed properly to record that vote? Some of these machines will allow you to print what's called a receipt, so you can actually see who you voted for. Others don't do that. Sometimes when those screens are designed in such a way that it can make it difficult to see all the races. There was a case in Florida a few years back where a U.S. House election, a lot of people didn't vote for that race, and it largely because of the way the screens were designed, it was in a place on the screen that people had difficulty seeing.
Is there any way to tell if it's better for there to be uniformity? Is it better for a state to insist on one kind of machine throughout the state?
That probably would make things a lot easier in terms of you could move machines around if there are mechanical defects, and it probably would mean there's a uniformity in the probability of your vote being counted given that you've cast it. So it's probably something I would be in favor of, but that would be expensive. I mean, these technologies are not cheap, and they're not used that often. We have elections every year or two depending on the locality. And you store these things and get them out and use them every couple of years. It's expensive to replace them frequently.
Well, of course, all of this is about accessibility and making sure that you have the most robust and firm democracy that you can. And that means allowing and encouraging as many people as possible to vote. So, Irving Joyner, I want to talk to you and talk about the ways in which we can improve accessibility. And if there are efforts now to suppress the vote, are there counter efforts underway in the state?
Well, one of the things that you want to do is to encourage people to vote. And in order to do that, they need to know where to vote. One of the things that we guard against is the last minute changes in the voting site. That we have going on, as well as challenges at the poll itself. I've been working with a coalition of groups and organizations in North Carolina, and we have aggressively sought to get volunteers out to as many polling places as possible, particularly those in African American and minority communities, to be available for people who are challenged at the poll, and to let them understand what's going on and how to deal with the situation in the event that they are challenged, and then also to challenge those individuals who purport to be the challengers to make sure that they are legitimately there and that they adhere to the law in terms of being able to identify those people who ought not vote. We have not seen a situation where, anyone has shown up at the polls who should not vote. In this early voting period, of course, they can come in and register and vote the same day, and we encourage that. And we encourage people not only to go out and vote, but then to go back and bring other people to the poll and vote. And this period of time from October 18th through November 3rd is ideal for that, and one of the great innovations within our law as it relates to voting, that people can go in and that's voter ID right there, because you have to identify yourself before you can register. And if you register and vote at the same time, then you have to show all of the ID. Those people who have previously registered, they've already shown ID, and all they have to do is show up and give the magic numbers and words to the registrar, and they're able to vote, and that's a very effective process.
So same-day voting is even safer and more fraud-resistant in that way because of that. And motor voter as well, the idea that you can register to vote when you get your driver's license, and of course the state wants to make sure they know who they're looking at when they issue a driver's license, so that's a pretty secure process.
Yeah, and things that ought to be encouraged, and those are the very things that people are trying to discourage. And they discourage them because it is these other efforts, these type efforts, that bring in African Americans and Latinos and Indians and poor people and the elderly and other persons who are disinclined to vote. And so we want to encourage that.
What has been the impact of motor voter and same-day voting and early voting on the registration and voting patterns in minority communities?
A significant increase in the number of people who are registered and then the number of people who actually go out and vote. As you can see already in this election, there is upward in many places 50% increase in the number of people utilizing and early voting over 2010 and then over 2008 because people understand the convenience factor that is present there, and not getting caught up on election day with long lines where you have to stand there for 3 or 4 hours just to vote. And so we think it's a marked improvement in the process. And again, the ideal thing for our democratic system, because we want people to participate. And now you have a few people out there that want to decrease that participation, according to them, in the name of democracy.
Jason Roberts, let's take a look at other countries when it comes to technology. Are there other models that we can look at that would encourage greater participation and fewer errors?
Well, there are some countries that have compulsory voting. You can be fined if you don't vote. I'm not sure I would personally advocate for that, but and Professor Joyner is correct. We actually have some of the best technology in the world in terms of ensuring that the correct people are who they say they are when they register, and we have very limited voter fraud. We don't have as high a voter turnout as other countries, and so that's where our efforts have not been as good as a country compared to other democracies.
I want to thank you both for being on the program today. Jason Roberts, a political science professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Jason Roberts, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Irving Joyner, professor at North Carolina Central University School of Law. Always good to see you. Thanks for being on the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. Our website is stateofthings.org, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.